So anybody has any questions, you can ask Maharaj. Before you gave, they are asking me, what is the meaning of fasting? Why do we fast? In the particular day, why we fast?
Fasting is performed for several purposes. The most important reason for any spiritual discipline is to increase our condition, the facility of our condition to meditate and remember Krishna. In other words, when we reduce our bodily necessities, we have more time to completely center all of our energies on the remembrance of Krishna. Therefore, the essence of fasting is that by minimizing the time we take to eat, the energy of our body to digest foods for our own maintenance, we utilize every drop of that energy to immerse our thought in Krishna. Traditionally, on fast days, you do not work either. Traditionally, on a fast day, you do nothing except japa and puja and sadhu satsang and nothing else. Just like Maharaj Parikshit, he made a vow to fast till death when he was given the notice that he had only 7 days to live. Now, why did he vow to fast till death? Not simply for the sake of fasting, but so that he had absolutely nothing else to distract his attention away from hearing the glories of the Lord through Shukadeva Goswami. In other words, he wanted every drop of his mental and physical energy to be going into the remembrance of Krishna. So if you're fasting and you're doing all nonsense while you're fasting, engaging in so many worldly activities, the real benefits of the fast are minimal. The real purpose is to redirect all of our energies to that process by which we can remember Krishna. Just like Ekadasi is a day when people fast. The disciples of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, they chant 16 rounds a day minimum. Prabhupada said, if you fast on Ekadasi, you should chant at least 25 rounds every day on that day. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, his disciples, they would fast every day on Ekadasi, and they would chant at least 64 rounds every day, or more. So the real purpose of everything we do is to fix our mind on Krishna. And fasting is a very, very effective means of assisting us in fixing our mind exclusively on the name and the form and the pastimes of the Lord. Another reason for fasting is health. Fasting is very, very good for the health. And by fasting regularly, our body is in better physical condition to render service to the Lord. So if we're fasting for a better body physical condition, for the purpose of increasing our service, that is also a spiritual pursuit. Another reason for fasting is to increase our compassion, especially for rich people. You do not generally sympathize with the suffering of another unless you have suffered like that. Like oftentimes a person who is born in a very poor family who becomes very rich, that person is more inclined toward being very philanthropic to the poor than someone who was simply brought up in a rich family, because he has experienced in his own life the sufferings of the poor. So therefore, poor people are hungry, often. And a rich man, in order for him to really have a sense of compassion for the poor, he should understand and know what hunger is like. Therefore, by fasting, you have a sense of the suffering of hunger pains. And then when someone approaches you who is hungry, you will be very, very charitable and very compassionate, because you will feel for them. You have been through it. Another reason is for the economic purpose of maintaining a high supply of foodstuffs for the whole society. If a society is oriented in such a way where everyone fasts 2 days a month from grains, grains are the staple food for everyone. That means how much more of a surplus of grains there will be for everyone if everyone does not eat grains for 2 days a month. And it will strengthen the economic position, especially in a village environment. So this is one of the reasons people would fast. But as devotees, we should understand that the most important and most essential reason why we do anything is for the purification of our heart. Now, the purification of our heart does not take place simply from refraining from food, but it takes place by the remembrance of Krishna. Om apavitra pavitro vasaravavastam gatopi va yasmare pundrikaksham sabhyabhyantarasuchi. Whether one is impure or pure, if you remember the beautiful lotus-eyed personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who is all pure, you will become purified from within and without. So on special days like Janamastami, Ram Navami, on these auspicious days, we should try as far as possible to put everything else aside except the glorification directly of the name and the glories of the Lord. And therefore, we refrain from doing anything else except kirtan, bhajan, puja, sadhu satsang, and like that. Like Maharaj Pariksit, we don't want any distractions. When will I eat? Then you eat, you have to rest, you have to digest. You don't, no distractions. You simply want to focus all your attention on hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. And Ekadasi, the 11th day of the new moon and the full moon, is astrologically a very auspicious time to make spiritual advancement. So on these days also it is recommended to minimize our bodily necessities and maximize the process of hearing and chanting.
There are different levels of fast. As you say, some people only eat fruits and milk. Some people only take water. Some people don't take water also. Some people just refrain from grains. So how do we fit ourselves in these kind of standards? How does a new coming devotee fit himself in these standards?
However we can best serve, it depends on our particular service. Just like, for instance, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, his disciples, the brahmacharis and the sannyasis, they would perform nirjali kadasi. They would not take any water or any food for the 24 hours from sunrise to sunrise. Now there was one brahmachari, he had a very important preaching program that he was to attend and deliver a lecture and answer questions. He was in the evening and he was feeling very weak. So he approached his Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and said that tonight you will have to send someone else to this preaching program because I'm just too weak, because I'm a little sickly, and I will not be able to perform good in my preaching tonight. So Bhakti Siddhanta said, and you eat. We are not attached to the fasting, we are attached to the service. Whatever best way you are most fit to serve, you do like that. If you can fast and at the same time be fully strong to serve, then you can fast. That is very purifying. to restrain the senses from sense gratification is very purifying to the heart. But at the same time, the whole purpose of restraining our senses from sense gratification is to engage our senses fully in God's service. If fasting interferes with our service, then the result is counterproductive to our spiritual advancement. You see, we are not tapasis. We are not simply performing tapasya for the sake of tapasya. We are performing tapasya only for the purpose of increasing our service to God. So a very strict fast is no water and no food whatsoever. Also, in the strict sense, on Ekadasi, you're not supposed to pass urine, you're not supposed to pass stool, you're not supposed to shave, you're not supposed to cut your nails, you're not supposed to decorate your body, you're not supposed to do anything, you're not supposed to sleep. This is the strict observance of Ekadasi. From sunrise to sunrise, you do nothing but chant the names of God and read the scriptures. You're not supposed to work either. That's strict Ekadasi. Nothing in your body, nothing out of your body. Except the holy name. Huh? Now, if you cannot do that, then at least don't eat or drink and chant the holy names. If you can't do that, then you just drink water. If you can't do that, then you just eat fruit. If you can't do that, then if you can't do that, then once a day only you eat food but no grains. If you can't do that, then twice a day but no grains. If you can't do that, then three times a day but no grains. If you can't do that, then just don't eat grains. And chant the holy names. So depending on your level of capacity to perform tapasya, and according to the particular service you're expected to render, then you should fast accordingly. But we are not so concerned with very, very strict fasts. We are more concerned with the understanding and applying the basic principle which underlies the reason for fasting, and that is to increase our devotion, our service to God, and minimize our need for sense gratification and bodily maintenance. Sometimes fasting makes one proud and hard-hearted. Huh? Just like I was speaking to devotees once, that devotees, they do not eat grains. So sometimes the devotee is performing near Jali Kadasi. And other devotees, they're just not eating grains. Once a day they eat just like fruit and other such foods. So sometimes the person who's performing near Jali Kadasi, he's looking at the others who are eating. They say, look at these pigs stuffing their faces with all this food on Ekadasi. They're not very advanced. Look at how advanced I am. I'm not eating anything. I'm better than them. It's better to sit down with them and eat than to think like that. Because pride is worse than eating. Huh? If you could remain very humble and think, my God, these devotees, they are so advanced that they can eat and still make great spiritual advancement. But me, I'm so sinful. If I try to do that, I'll go to hell. So I'm so much lower than all of them, I better fast. They're very exalted. If you can be like that, then you should fast. But if you're thinking, just see, I'm more spiritually advanced than any of these people, then better you eat and become puffed up. Any other questions?
Is it the thought of even eating? Suppose we like some particular dish and we remember that dish on the day of Ekadasi and we think, oh my God, eating like that. So is it considered as the breaking of the fast by that thought, that desire?
In Kali Yuga, you are not responsible for your thoughts. You are only responsible for your words and your actions. In previous yugas, the thought was no different than the act. Because in previous yugas, people had such control of their minds. To think about sense gratification, you have to suffer the sinful reaction of doing it. But in Kali Yuga, your mind is so uncontrolled and wild that God knows that we'll all go to hell instantly if he keeps this high standard. So therefore, Krishna in Kali Yuga has given many concessions. Concession is whatever you think you're not responsible, there's no karmic reaction. And whatever you say or do, you are. But if you continuously think on something, by contemplating the objects of the senses, Krishna says, Jayato Vishayam Pongsang Sangasteshu Vajayate. By contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops attachment for them. From such attachment, lust. From lust, anger when it's unfulfilled. And through this process, we gradually engage in sinful acts. So therefore, a person should be very aware that although the thought may come to his mind, with his intelligence, he has to replace that thought with positive spiritual thoughts. By chanting the names of God, by engaging the mind in positive service to God, by reading the scriptures, these are ways that we can replace these sinful thoughts with positive spiritual thoughts for purification. If we're not willing to do that, and we continue to contemplate sense gratification, in due course of time, the mind will force us to engage in the physical acts of these sinful activities. So when you are thinking like that, you should use your intelligence and withdraw your mind from that thought and fix it on Krishna. By any means. Any other questions?
What is the position of this Kubera with Narayan and other demigods? They say he is the treasure for demigods. Also, we have seen Kubera next to Badinara and then in Badinara. Who is he and what is the relation?
There is a demigod who is in charge of the treasury of the demigods. And in Badrik Ashram, there is a story of how... I don't know the specific story, you may know it. He personally came down to assist the Lord in his lila at that place. It's not that he has necessarily a special relationship with Narayan more than other demigods. But in this particular lila, he assisted Badri Nara Narayan, Rishi Badri Narayan. Like that. Just like in Tirupati. In Tirupati, the story is that Srinivas was living the same way as Badri Narayan. He was living like a sadhu, like a hermit, without anything, simply meditating. And Lakshmi Devi came to him, and then they were to have marriage. And of course, he had no money for marriage. So Kubera, being the treasurer of the demigods, he asked him to help provide the finances for a nice marriage. So Kubera provided, and then he made a vow. He said that, I vow that I, in this particular incarnation, I don't have anything to repay you. But from now on, my devotees, whenever they come to my temple, the Venkateshwar temple, they will give the best things they have to pay this dowry that I owe. So therefore, every devotee of Venkateshwar is obliged by this vow to give the best wealth they have to help the Lord of their life pay the debt that he has to Kubera until the end of Kali Yuga. The debt is like this. Until the end of Kali Yuga, all my devotees will give the best they have to pay you off. So this way, Kubera has a very special relationship in this sense. That when the Lord appears as Badri Narayan, or when he appears as Venkateshwar, as a very poor sadhu, he has no money, Kubera comes with supplies. Because he has all the assets of the treasures of the heavens. You see?
What's the importance of shaving off the head in such a deep places? In terms of the energy of the
Prabhupada, when he was asked, why do you shave your head? He would answer in many different ways. Sometimes he would say, because it's very clean. hair is a very dirty thing. You know, Matajis, you know what it is to wash your hair and dry your hair. Very time consuming. I have personal experience. When I was living as a sadhu in India, my hair was down past my waist. And it was matted. And I would take my bath, and it would just be like, you know, you just, there's no towel, you just go, and it's just like wet and dirty. And to wash it is very difficult. And then when I shaved my head, the first thing is when I took a bath, I couldn't believe how easy it was. I was thinking, my God, it's just like, bus, finish. I was thinking, how clean, how simple, how easy, how nice. So cleanliness is next to godliness. So the shaving your head is very clean. Another thing is it's very simple. In the sense that in this day and age, people are very proud of their hair. I mean, my God, it's one of the biggest industries in the world, hair fashions. There's male hair fashions, women's hair fashions. In America, there's beauty parlors. Every woman with any amount of money goes to the beauty parlor once a week and gets certain fashion designs of her hair. And men, they have certain styles that they have. They go to the barber shop to have. And they spend a lot of money like this too. Because they're all wanting to look very beautiful. And they're all competing. Who can look more beautiful through the way they comb their hair? So when you shave your head, you remove yourself from all competition. It is also said that hair is a very much a sign of a person's pride. Because a person is very proud of his hair. And when you shave your head, it's a sign of cutting off all your pride. So that is another reason. Another reason is it's a sign of renunciation of one's pride. It's a sign of renunciation. One time, one lady, she was a newspaper reporter, and she had very stylish hair. And she was wearing what they call mini skirt. You have her? Very short dress. And she had very pretty legs. So she was a newspaper reporter from, I think, Newsweek magazine. So she asked Prabhupada, why do you shave your head? She said, it's very challenging. You know, in women in America, they have this women's liberation. Where they don't like anything that men do that women don't do. Right? It's like, you're doing this, why women don't do it, but you do it in your movement. There must be some male chauvinism behind this. So she was very challenging. She said, Swamiji, why do you shave your head? And Prabhupada looked at her and said, why do you shave your legs? And she was speechless. She didn't know what to say. And then Prabhupada said, because to understand God, you have to have a cool head. He said, better to have a cool head than cold legs.
Maharaj, it is a practice in our custom that at the end of 1 year of birth, first birthday, they cut the hair of the small kid. So, but how in any way the pride is coming into the kid when he doesn't know what exactly pride is?
That is a different purpose. The shaving the head of the child, there are many reasons. Amongst these many reasons, one is it is a samskara by which the parent is offering that child as a sacrifice to God. In other words, sacrifice doesn't mean you have to kill the child, but you sacrifice something of the child to God. And that is the hair. So it's a purificatory act that's purifying for both the parents and the child. But the child is undergoing this sacrifice, and the parents are also willing to offer their child as a sacrifice. And two is, it is said when you cut the child's hair at a young age, it grows better. It's much more full and rich. Huh? In India today, most people cut their child's hair just because they want their hair to be more beautiful in the future. But actually, it's meant to be a sacrifice. And that sacrifice is a meditation on how actually our body, our mind, our soul, our words, everything is the property of God. And this ceremony is really meant to be meditated upon, that yes, I belong to God, the parent is singing, and my child belongs to me. And the child should understand, and I should understand, that really our life is God's property. And this is just a token gesture of accepting this truth, that everything is the property of God, and that everything of ourselves is the property of God. It is all meant for the pleasure of God.
When your father dies, usually that's a custom here in India. Can you shave us?
Yes.
There's a reason there.
The principle is the same. Is that that particular time, it's supposed to be a time of renunciation. You're supposed to be feeling a sense of renunciation and a sense of devotion to God at that time. Shaving of the head is a gesture toward God of renunciation. So when the father dies, it's a time where we should feel a great sense of renunciation toward God. In other words, we should be accepting the fact that God, this father of mine, he is your son. You have given me this father. You can take away this father. It is according to your sweet will. I am your servant. Huh? This is a renounced spirit, to accept whatever God offers us is mercy. And therefore, the external manifestation that you're taking thing in this spirit is you make this gesture of renunciation, of shaving the head. Now, there are many social reasons for doing it. But this is really the essential, real purpose of doing it. At the time of the death of a father or a loved one, it should give us realizations of the temporary nature of this body and the realization of the supreme authority of God in our life. Huh? He gives life and he takes life. And at this time, where it's actually a very, very deep and very, very moving experience of our emotions within our life, it should cause us to become more and more renounced in the spirit of devotion to God. So we should take it in that light and make great spiritual advancement. But if we just do it because it's a custom, there's no spiritual advancement. Simply shaving your head when your father dies because it's the custom, you make no spiritual advancement. The purpose of shaving your head is to make spiritual advancement. You have to have a philosophical understanding why you're doing it. Then you do make spiritual advancement. You do contemplate on these truths while you're having your head shaved. And when you see yourself with a head, with your shaved head, and when others see you with the head shaved, everyone is meditating, should be meditating on this philosophical truth of life.
Is it always that you are going to the pure devotee, or can we go
without
a pure devotee?
You can do as you like. You will not understand. The holy place can only be revealed to you through the mercy of the great souls. You can only scratch the external surface of the holy places of pilgrimage on your own. But it is the great devotees of the Lord who bring life, who extract the essence of that holy place and make it visible to you. This point is very important. It is said in Srimad Bhagavatam, in Kali Yuga, instead of going to the holy places to associate with holy people, people go simply to take bath. Simply by taking bath, there is some purification, no doubt. But by associating with holy men who can reveal the real essence of the Dham to you, that is how you can really take full advantage of that Tirtha Yatra. You see, our tendency is to see things materially. Huh? But the holy men, they, by their words and by their example, they teach us how to see the real spiritual significance of the holy Dham. Huh? That is very important. Also, going to a place of pilgrimage is like a ritual. But when you are with a holy man, he actually internalizes that whole experience and makes it more than a ritual, but it makes it a very sublime means of purifying your heart and deepening your faith and your love. It is a good thing to go.
If you have told already, you can always go.
It's so difficult for us.
But then you should understand it's a ritual. But that ritual, if you have the understanding now, then you can go there with the proper understanding. And if you take my words with you, then you're really going with a devotee. Huh?
Difficult to find a pure devotee. If I go to a holy place, how to look out for a devotee? If you are going to associate with him, you said that you should not associate with him at that place. Because he may not be with you till you reach there, but there you can look out for a
devotee. You see, previously it was very easy. But these days, there are so many people and so many, it's hard to understand who is really a great soul. That is why it's best to live your life completely under the guidance of a guru, so you can understand who is great souls and when to go to holy places and how to go to holy places. Huh? What do you have to lose? Nothing is yours. Everything belongs to God. Nothing is yours. To think anything is yours is an illusion. Correct? Do you think your business is yours? It belongs to God. If Krishna wants it back, why should you reject? Huh?
If I work hard for that business, like if I had not worked hard, I would have had.
Worked hard. If somebody works hard to rob a bank and gets all that money, and then the government catches him and takes it back, and then he asks, well, I worked so hard for this money, why are you taking it away from me? Because it was never yours, rascal, you stole it. What is the difference? You can work hard, but it's Krishna's. If he wants to take it, it's his to take. It's not yours to complain, right? If you think it's yours, then you have stolen it.
So we have to look after it. Like, we have to look after whenever we have that thing. Maybe wealth.
We have to meditate. We have to have a spiritual discipline in our life by which we can realize the truth that God is the proprietor of everything and everything is meant for His enjoyment. By associating with saintly persons, by hearing from them, by hearing the scriptures, by chanting the holy names, and by working in this spirit of devotion, we gradually come to the realization of how we are the eternal servants of God. We are meant for His enjoyment, and everything we have is meant for His enjoyment. The great souls have prayed, Maro Birakobi Joicha Toha Nityata Saprati Tua Adhikar. My Lord, if you want, you can kill me, or if you like, you can protect me. If you like, you can give me everything. If you like, you can take everything away. I am your eternal servant. You have every right to deal with me in any way you please. Huh? This is the attitude of a serious devotee. Now, this is from a very high level of thinking. From a more relative level of thinking, we can understand that everything that comes and everything that is taken is due to our previous karma. Huh? And that is a fact also, in the worldly sense. That due to our previous good karma, you see some people, two people are working just as hard, and one is a millionaire and one is still a pauper in the street. It's not simply by your work that you get the results. But it's according to the destiny that you have created in your previous lives. Huh? So due to some sinful act, you may be losing everything that you have now. That is your own, that is a reaction of what you have done in the past. But you see, God is the supreme controller, and the laws of karma are ultimately working under His direction. So He's fair, He's just. So we should rise above this karmic way of thinking and realize that ultimately everything is the mercy of God. Huh? And then we can be satisfied, we can be peaceful, whether everything is given or everything is taken. Huh? You see, God will do whatever is required. When you become God's devotee, then He will deal with you in whatever way is best for you to advance. If your riches is an impediment, if your attachment to your riches is an impediment to your spiritual growth, then Krishna will start taking things away. But if it's not an impediment, if actually you're seeing it in the proper perspective and using it for God's service, then Krishna will give you much more. There's no need to take it away. He'll do whatever's best for your spiritual growth. When you surrender to Krishna, you're no longer under the laws of karma. Whatever happens to you is what you need for your spiritual growth. Huh? When you don't surrender to Krishna, then you're simply, everything is the law of action and reaction. You gain and you lose according to your past deeds. Huh? You're going to lose everything anyway to today or tomorrow. Whenever that day comes, are you going to like it any better? Huh? But if we take it in the proper spirit of consciousness, we become elevated, we become purified through that experience. But if we take it in the wrong way, if we take it in the material way, why is this happening to me? This isn't fair. And you simply cheat yourself of a valuable opportunity to make spiritual advancement. And it's going to happen anyway tomorrow if it's not happening today, and you're not going to like it any better then. Right? So why not accept the inevitable for your spiritual advancement rather than fighting against the inevitable, which is a losing battle. Huh?
It's very difficult to understand. This is Krishna's mercy. We have been used to enjoy our material life and the sense pleasures, and suddenly we chant Hari name Krishna and we suffer difficulties. And it's very difficult to understand that it's the mercy of the Lord.
This is all nonsense. You think the people who are not chanting Hare Krishna are not suffering? In this world, everyone is suffering, today or tomorrow. At the best, there's a small gap of happiness between the suffering, right? Birth is suffering, is it not? What does the child do when he comes out of the womb? Does he laugh? Your doctors, has there ever been in history a time when the child comes out laughing? 100% of the times. Does the child ever come out silent? Like, Child comes out, and as soon as it realizes what's going on, it starts crying, correct? So you come to this world crying. Huh? And at the time, and when people, when the loved ones that you have so much attachment to, when they die, you cry. And when there's pain to your body, you cry. And at the time of death, when everything's ripped away, you cry. Right? So this world is a place of crying. And between tears, there's little small gaps of sense of pleasure. Prabhupada said, the pleasure of this world is really not pleasure. It's just the absence of pain for some time. And the example he gives, that in the old days, when a king wanted to punish someone, he would take very strong executioners and bring that criminal to the river. And they would hold him by the hair, and they would stick him under the water. And they would hold him under the water so he couldn't breathe. And they would hold him and hold him, and he'd be struggling, but he couldn't move. Until his lungs were about to burst, his head was about to burst, he was about to die of suffocation. And he was just meditating. The only thing he wanted in life was a breath of air. And then the executioner, at that very critical moment, he would lift his head up, and the person would breathe and go, and it would be, how beautiful, how wonderful this is. This, Ananda, Ananda. And then a few minutes later, he ducks him down again. It's the same thing. So that's the way this material world is. There's so much suffering, so much pain, but every now and then there's some relief, and we think, how beautiful. What is considered the most highest form of pleasure in this world? In the Western world especially, it's considered sex life. And considering that there's almost 700 million people in India, this sense must also be similar here. Population development is not so much according to very systematic planning of families, but it's usually because it feels so good, you want to do it, right? But what is that good feeling? It's not a pleasure. It's just the relief of a pain. The fact is, lusty desires is painful. Huh? It's just driving you crazy, and you just have to get some release from it. And the release is that sexual contact, and really, it's just a temporary relief of the pain, of the anxiety, of that desire for sex. Prahlad Maharaj in Srimad Bhagavatam says that sex life is simply scratching an itch, and nothing more than that. Huh? You have an itch, and it's driving you crazy. Did you ever have an itch? And when you scratch it, it feels so good. You're just like, right? It's the same way. The sound I make is the same sound people make when they have sex, right? You just scratch like this. It feels, but actually, it's not a good feeling. It's just a relief of a horrible feeling. Actually, that's all sense gratification is, on every level. Our minds are agitated because we want to eat something. And we want it to taste good. And we're agitated like anything because we want that, and our tongue is just going, right? And then we eat it. And we think it's really a pleasure to eat it. But actually, it's not the pleasure of eating it. It's the relief of the anxiety that you had wanting it. And like any other pleasure in this world, that relief is very temporary. There's a little gap of relief. And then again, you're agitated because you want more. And this agitation is painful. Correct? So that's the nature of this world. It's a place of suffering. And sometimes there's a relief of the suffering, and that's called pleasure. So really, according to Prahlad and the great souls, there's really no real positive pleasure in this world. The only real positive pleasure is on the spiritual platform. The platform of the soul. The soul's nature is pleasure. There is no pain. The soul's nature is to love. Love is real pleasure. But that love is eternal. It is not the kind of love that simply bears the fruit of pain in due course of time. All the love for the material objects of this world bears the fruit of pain in due course of time, does it not? Either death or before, great sorrow takes place.
We see that the pure devotee, the Guru Maharaj, he deals with many disciples, and the disciples have many faults. But we never find Guru Maharaj all time yelling.
What?
We don't find Guru Maharaj at them all time yelling at a disciple that you have this fault, you have this fault. He is all time merciful, calm and quiet, nicely telling the disciple. But we find ourselves, our tolerance is so low. We cannot tolerate some even mild nonsense also. So how to come over this tendency of, you know, all time yelling and criticizing?
The reason why you cannot... The reason one cannot tolerate the fault in another is because one cannot tolerate that same fault in oneself. And you don't want to admit it in yourself. But when you see it in another, you hate it. It's really something inside of yourself that you hate. It's not something in that person. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said, "The only reason why I find faults in others is because I am honeycombed with 500,000 faults myself." What you hate most about yourself because of your false ego, you don't want to admit. When you see that in another, you hate it, you despise it, you can't tolerate it. But you see, by blaming that person or criticizing that person, there's no benefit. You only implicate yourself in offense, in sinful karma. So therefore, when we see the faults in another, we should become introspective and think, it's my impurities that can't tolerate that. If I was pure, I would love this person. I would be able to tolerate whatever injustices he's performing upon me. But because of my impurities in my own heart, I cannot tolerate it. So there's nothing wrong with him, the problem's with me. It's like it is said, every time you point one finger at one person, at your enemy, there's three fingers pointing toward yourself. Which means you should evaluate your own faults at least three times for every time you evaluate the faults of another. Huh? But because of our false ego, we don't want to admit any faults within ourselves. We want to blame everyone else for everything. But a devotee in the Lord, he is not like that. Jesus Christ said, before pointing out the speck in another person's eye, you should take the mountain out of your own eye. Huh? It's also said in the Bible, judge not lest ye be judged. God is the judge, not us. Let God judge the other person, not us. We should try to make ourselves fit before we have to go before the judge. Right?
How to make it possible to...
Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, Amani na manadena kirtaniya sadahari. A sincere devotee offers all respects to others and expects no respect for oneself. If you expect respect from yourself, that means to the degree you want respect from yourself, to that degree you're going to find faults in others too. To the degree you want no respect for yourself, to that degree you're not going to see any faults in others. Huh? Fault finding is a sign of very, very serious disease of false ego within our heart. And the only way to rid ourselves of that false ego is through the process of purification, which takes place by chanting the holy names of God, And while we're chanting the holy names of God with our intelligence, we should check our lower self from engaging in these sinful acts of fault finding. And we should be always seeking the faults within ourself and trying to purify them. And always trying to see the good qualities in others. Well, that is an austerity. It is an austerity of the mind which should be accepted. In this material world, we are anxious to find the faults in others and point them out to the world, and point out to the world our own glories. But a sincere person on the spiritual path, he's very anxious to find the glories of others and point them out to the world. And he's always anxious to admit his own faults to the world. In the eyes of God, that is a great man.
Sometimes criticism for benefit of the other person, how do we differentiate between these two? Whether we are criticizing for the benefit of the other person or whether we are yelling out of false pride?
You have to very carefully evaluate what are your motives. And the next question is, are you in a position to improve that person by pointing out his faults? Will he actually listen to you and benefit? If it's just going to create antagonism, it's better to just be silent. And by your own example, by your own humble example, try to teach him. Right? Sometimes if you tell a person his faults, he just reacts very violently in his own mind. He doesn't take it positively, but you just ruin your relationship with him. So what is the use? You accept what is constructive. If you want to help the person, you do what's helpful. So to such a person, it's best by your own example to act so humble that that person feels ashamed. Huh? Without saying anything against him. If you are in a position where he will listen to you, then you can point out the faults. But you're doing it in a constructive way to help that person, not to put yourself at a higher position. You should do it in a spirit that you are his servant. Just like sometimes a mother chastises the child, but she feels like a servant. She's doing it to help the child. She's not doing it so that the world thinks the mother's better than the child. Right? So we should be in the spirit of the servant of whoever we're trying to help. And we should accept whatever's favorable in helping and serving that person. You're not really hearing it. If you really hear what's being said, you will be a God-realized soul. But if we read it inattentively, that result will not be there. There will certainly be purification, but the complete purification takes place according to the degree that we are attentive with what we are reading. And we are applying the instructions to our life step by step. Huh? What does it mean by hearing? There's hearing and there's listening. Listening means it goes in one ear and out the other. Hearing means it goes in one ear and it makes such an impact in your life that you'll sacrifice anything to live according to what you've heard. Huh? That's hearing. That means the instructions of the Srimad Bhagavatam, when you hear it with such gravity and sincerity that everything you hear, it changes your life and you apply that principle to your life, then you've heard the whole nine cantos. When you just read it, and it just goes in one ear, and a little may remain there, but most of it goes out the other ear. You haven't really heard. You haven't really assimilated. You haven't really practiced what's being said. And you haven't really heard. The Bhagavatam is insisting you have to give up all sense gratification. You have to completely depend on God's mercy. That was the lesson that Prahlad Maharaj taught, is it not? Now, have you heard that? If you've heard it, you're doing it. If you've just listened to it, then you've read it, but you're still going on as before. Huh? So there's a difference between reading it and hearing it. Hearing means assimilating. But it was not just his thoughts. You see, this was a very special lesson. Actually, that person was a pure devotee. Huh? But the Lord, in order to teach those in the renounced order of life how serious their vow is, he wanted to make a very, very, very extreme example out of this devotee. Because it's sad, the reaction was, after this took place, none of his devotees would even consider sense gratification in their dreams, right? But that person, after he committed suicide, what happened? In his spiritual body, he came to Lord Chaitanya every night and would sing beautiful songs about Krishna to him. Huh? So he wasn't just an ordinary person, would become a ghost if they commit suicide. But this person, in his original spiritual body, he would come and sing to Lord Chaitanya. So that means this person was pure. But Lord Chaitanya was simply using him as a very, very extreme example to show the world how serious these vows are. Traditionally, that is the case. For preaching, sometimes there's exceptions to the traditional rules and regulations, but the principle, the spirit, must be upheld. It's like Prabhupada would perform marriage ceremonies. A sannyasi is strictly forbidden to perform marriage ceremonies. A sannyasi is strictly forbidden to associate with materialistic people. Huh? For preaching purposes, Lord Chaitanya, he wouldn't associate with the king. But then again, he allowed the king to disguise himself and he associated with him. So for preaching purposes, sometimes the devotee is willing to take those risks. But he shouldn't take those risks for his sense gratification. But he can take certain risks for the sake of showing compassion to others. What is that again?
Yeah, what is the pride like? When you look at others who are totally materialistic, when I know something, truth. So when I look at them, I have a feeling that these people are wasting their time. I am better off. I know something. So what is the pride?
You should feel like that. But you shouldn't be proud of yourself. You should be proud of the mercy of your guru. And you should be proud of the mercy of Krishna that has given you a life in pursuance of truth. Otherwise, this human civilization is a civilization of animals. Huh? They're completely wasting their lives without any real concept of the goal of self-realization. And you would be in that same situation without the mercy of Krishna and the sadhus. Huh? So you should feel fortunate. You should not feel proud. You should feel fortunate. You should feel proud of the mercy that has come upon you. And you should feel very humbled by the good fortune that has come upon you. You shouldn't think I'm better than them. You should think by the mercy of my guru, which I'm so proud of, I'm more fortunate than them. Huh? And you shouldn't think I'm better than them, but you should think that let me give them my fortune. Huh? You should feel not proud of yourself, but you should feel compassion toward them. You should be so proud of the mercy of Guru and Krishna that you want to share it with the world and make everyone fortunate. Huh?
You may be having desires or you may anger for something. You may think that, well, I may use this for God's worship. How do you know that that is true? I may be using it. If I get it, I may not use it.
Two things.
I may anger for something now, which I may say, okay, I'll use it for God. I'm angering only for that.
First of all, the Association of Advanced Devotees can help us clarify what really we should aspire for in life. And second of all, if we are sincere, we will honestly evaluate our motives. Huh? If we are insincere, we will justify our own desires for sense gratification in the name of God's service. It is really a question of your sincerity. And the best sign of your sincerity is rather than taking it in your own hands to discriminate, you reveal your mind to advanced devotees who can help you to make the right decisions in life in regard to what you should aspire for and what you should not aspire for.
Anchorings are always there, it's very difficult. You're constantly looking at others and your experience, and then you want to have something. But you may look at, I will use this for Krishna's bliss.
But you should not be attached. If you're doing it for Krishna's pleasure, you should accept that Krishna will give you what he wants you to have. Right? Krishna says, Patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhakta prayashtati. If you offer me a leaf, a water, a little fruit, with devotion, I will accept it. You don't have to be a rich man. You don't have to have material facilities to serve Krishna. All you need is a heart of devotion. And whatever little you have, you offer it. Now you may want something great to offer it to Krishna, but you don't require it. If Krishna only wants you to offer a leaf or a flower, but you want to offer a diamond ring, huh? You should be content that Krishna only wants the leaf and water from you. So why should you want the diamond ring if Krishna doesn't want it? If Krishna wants a leaf from you, why should you want a diamond ring? Right? Krishna wants that diamond ring from you. He'll give you the diamond ring to give to you. You should aspire for the service. You should not aspire for the objects of the service. Right? Now, if the spiritual master tells you, you must get this, and you should try for it with all your energy. But just the trying for it is the service, whether you get it or not. Right? If you never get it, you get the same credit as if you got it, if you try for it. Because Krishna simply wants our devotion. He doesn't care about the material thing. The material thing means nothing to him. Krishna only is pleased by bhakti. How do you worship the Ganges? You take water from the Ganges and you say, "My dear Ganga Mata, please accept this offering." And you drop the water. You think she needs your water? It's her water anyway. There's hundreds of trillions of gallons of water flowing at any given moment in the Ganges. And you're taking one handful from her and offering it back. You think that she thinks, "Oh, now I'm satisfied. I have one handful of water." She's satisfied by the devotion in which you offer it. The water is just a means of expressing your devotion, right? But it's the devotion that she accepts. So similarly, all wealth is already God's property. You cannot offer anything to Him. All you can offer is your devotion. Everything else is already His. You're just utilizing certain objects of this world as a means of expressing your devotion. But the devotion is something internal. It's a state of consciousness. So we should not hanker for anything except devotion. We should not hanker for anything except service. Huh? Now you may want something material to offer to Krishna. You may try to get it. But you shouldn't be in anxiety whether you get it or not. You should know that it's just the sentiment of love that I'm trying for it that Krishna is accepting. Whether I get it or not. Right? That's called detachment. Krishna told Arjuna, don't be attached to winning this war. Just be attached to fighting as best you can for me. Success or failure, he said, that's up to me. That's for me to decide. It's not up to for you to decide. You simply have to give every bit of your energy to try. And if you do that, you're going to go back to Godhead, whether you win or lose. It makes no difference. Krishna says, it makes no difference to me whether you win or lose. The only difference it makes to me is how you're trying, what type of devotion you're endeavoring. But by performing that ritual with a desire for that feeling to be there, gradually it will be there. Huh? If you simply perform the ritual for the sake of the ritual, there's very little advancement. But if you're performing the ritual with a deep desire that that feeling comes, then the feeling will come. If you do not have the desire to love Krishna, you should at least have the desire to desire love, to love Krishna. And if you don't have the desire to love Krishna, you should have the desire to desire to desire to love Krishna. How many of us love Krishna? How many of us have the desire to love Krishna? But we can have the desire for that desire, for the desire to love Krishna.
For a short time it should be there, but you forget about
it. But then when you associate with devotees again, you remember. Correct? That's why it's very important to have regular association with devotees. Correct?
Therefore,
you have to make a priority in your life, the association of devotees. And whenever the opportunity is there, you should take it. You'll find, if you take it very seriously, that you'll make time. There are so many little minutes and seconds throughout the day that we waste. And if we just don't waste those and save them, then we'll have more and more time to associate with devotees. Correct? And Krishna's in your heart. He sees how much you are seriously trying. And He will reciprocate. Everything is based on our desires. Just like Krishna, when He played His flute on the Vaspurnima evening of the Sarat season, the gopis left their homes, left everything to meet Krishna. But some of the gopis, their fathers, their husbands, they would not allow them to go. They would literally forcibly put them in a room, lock all the doors and lock all the windows and guard it so that the gopis could not get out to go with Krishna. Now while most of the gopis were dancing with Krishna all night, the other gopis were locked in their rooms. They wanted to go so bad, but they couldn't go. So you know what Krishna did? From within their hearts, he danced with them. Because their desire was so strong to go. Now, if the gopis said, well, they won't let me go, so I'll just watch television tonight. What can I do? It's Krishna's mercy. I'm not allowed to go, so let me watch, you know, what's the latest program tonight. If you do like that, then Krishna, you think Krishna's going to reveal himself in your heart? No, he's going to say, let him. He'll just reveal the television within your heart. God reveals himself according to how you approach him. But those gopis, they didn't want anything. They were simply in their heart. They wanted Krishna so bad. They were more absorbed in the Rasleela than the gopis who were with Krishna. Huh? They were more with Krishna than the gopis who were there. Correct? Because their minds were completely intensified in thinking of Krishna, in separation. So if you really want the association of devotees, but it's actually impossible, then that desire in and of itself, Krishna will give you the association from within your heart just by your desire. Huh? And because of that desire, whatever opportunity you do have to associate with the devotees, you'll maximize every second of it. Some people take things for granted. Huh? Some people, they like live in the temple, they're with devotees all the time, they're during class, they're like, I have to sit through this class every day. Right? They're not really very anxious because they're taking the words of the Bhagavatam for granted. But someone who's only allowed to come once a week, all week he's thinking, how much I need it, how much I want it. But I just don't have time. But I need it, I want it so bad. I'll have to make time, however possible. Then when you do finally get there, you're sitting there like this. And every word, you're just waiting for the next word to just grasp onto and just embrace it to the core of your heart and relish it, right? Hearing one class a week like that is more beneficial than sleeping through seven. Right? It is said absence makes the heart grow fonder and familiarity breeds contempt. So sometimes Krishna puts you in a situation just to increase your desire. Because if you don't have that increased desire, you will, in that situation, if you have too much, you take it for granted. Huh? Now if the opportunity provides itself and you don't take it, then Krishna will see, he doesn't want it. So whenever the opportunity is there to associate with devotees, you should run full speed ahead to take that association. Sadhu satsang. And whatever time you don't have that association, you should just accept that that is an opportunity to increase the anticipation so that when you do get the association, you will not take it for granted. You will take full advantage of every relative second. Huh? You will take every word, every syllable to heart. So the first thing is by your own example, you have to set the standard you want them to see. Huh? You have to, more than anything in a child's life, a child is very influenced by what he sees the parents doing. It's not so much what you tell them as what they see. You have to tell them the right thing. They have to be educated to understand why you're doing what you're doing. So you must instruct them. But what they see will really either make what you tell them meaningful or meaningless. If you tell them something but they don't see that you're not doing it yourself, it's meaningless. But if you tell them something and they see how dedicated and committed you are to doing it, then it's going to have a very great impact on them. Correct? So that's the first thing. You see, children are very perceptive, more than you think. They might look like stupid little children playing around and just doing all nonsense, but actually they see through you. They see right into your heart. You cannot hide things from your children. You may, intellectually you can hide things, but you cannot hide the impressions on their hearts. If you're a hypocrite, they know you're a hypocrite. You can't hide it. You have to be genuine in your devotion yourself, and they will recognize that, and that will have a tremendous impact in their life. So the first thing you have to do is become very strict yourself. If not for your own spiritual advancement, out of your love for your children, you owe it to them. Correct? And second of all, according to your means, you should try to monitor the environment that your children is entering into in this world. You should try as far as possible to restrict any association with sinful environment. It may not be entirely, but according to your capacity, you should not neglect the needs of your child in this regard. You should be very careful to see who your child's associating with. And at the very, if you see he's associating with somebody who's a bad influence, before he becomes attached to that person's association, or before he becomes influenced and habituated to those sinful activities, you should cut it at the very beginning, somehow or other. And you should encourage your child to associate with persons who are pious or saintly. Very difficult. That is why I am sannyasi. You have very difficult tasks, but you have to do it the best you possibly can. Your own example is completely in your own hands. You can set that example. That's the most important service you can render to your child. But the second thing is to put the child in a school where he's going to have the best environment within your means. Try to help the child select friends that you know that are coming from families that are pious. Otherwise, if it's a sinful family, he's going to go and he's going to associate with all kinds of bad influences. So you should be very, very careful.
So the restriction in our house, like, you may be curious about that, so you might try to.
He may do like that. But then what happens, you see, even though he may become a little, as he grows older, grows in his teenage years where he wants to adventure and explore into the nature of sinful life, he will have a very deep impression by his early years of what his parents has given him. And he'll very easily be able to see through it in due course of time, see through the fallacy of the promise of Maya and these sinful activities. Maya is simply giving us false promises at every moment. That if you accept this, you will be happy. But no matter how much you accept, you're never happy. Right? So if we raise the children properly, they will have the good, they will have spiritualized integrity in their life by which they will gradually be able to see through the falsity of the promises of Maya. So you have a very, very great responsibility. And you have to take it very seriously.
Is there such a funny question about admission about the kids?
now there's nothing, I mean, for the admission you have to pay donation or you have to put influence. Without that, your son won't get admission any good school. Do you think I'm doing the right thing or doing that?
You have to do the needful.
That's nothing wrong.
Whatever it takes to provide the best and most Krishna conscious environment for your child, you should do whatever is necessary. You can judge a tree by its fruit, or you can judge a thing by its result. Sometimes the ends justify the means. In this world, sometimes you just have to cheat. There's no. But if the reason why you're cheating is to do something not harmful but good for everyone involved, then you should cheat. It's not really cheating. It's actually service to God. Service to your child. That's the way this world is. This in Kali Yuga. Huh? It's like sometimes when we want to get books into the country, we have to pay off some customs man. Huh? Now, some people pay off customs man to get drugs in the country. We pay off a customs man to get spiritual books in the country. That's not really cheating, is it? Not that we do like that, but some people do like that. Any other questions? Remember the story of Kubera coming to Badri Kashram, why he came? Do you remember the story? Huh? I don't either. I know the principle. Because Badrinath was very poor, he was performing tapasya, right? He's sitting in lotus like this. And Lakshmi came as a tree. So he was very poor. So Kubera came because he was like Srinivas in Tirupati. He came to provide wealth and riches like that. But I don't remember exactly the story. It's in your book, but you should read it. Any other questions? So thank you very much for your kind patience sitting through my long-winded words.